Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, to celebrate National Hispanic Heritage Month, hear from Marie Arana, the literary director of the Library of Congress. Joined by author Juan Martinez, Arana discusses the importance of preserving and uplifting Latino history and her new book, Latinoland, a portrait of America's largest and least understood minority. The following conversation originally took place May 19th, 2024, and was recorded live at the American Writers Festival.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the next program here on the History and Biography stage at the American Writers Festival. My name is Courtney Borjas, and I am an Education Program Coordinator at the American Writers Museum, where we celebrate the past, promote the present, and inspire the future of American writing. In Maria Arana's groundbreaking new book, Latinoland, she draws from hundreds of interviews and prodigious research that emphasizes the diversity and little-known history of our largest and fastest-growing minority. A board member at the American Writers Museum, Maria Arana is the inaugural literary director of the Library of Congress, and she is the recipient of a 2020 Literary Award from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. Among her recent positions are the director of the National Book Festival and writer-at-large for the Washington Post. Discussing Latinoland with her is Northwestern University professor Juan Martinez, author of the novel Extended Stay. Welcome to you both.
Marie, I'm so happy that we get to do this together. I have so many questions for you, and we have so little time.
Thank you so much, Juan. It's such a pleasure and to get to know you and to know your work. Thank you for doing this.
Delighted. So I did have a bunch of questions, but one thing that I remembered just from as we were coming through is sort of the extraordinary process of making Latinoland into the book. For people who have not seen it, it's this extraordinary sweeping history of the Latina experience here in the US, but it's also it's a big book, and then the notes.
It's mostly notes. It's
mostly footnotes. How many people did you interview?
237.
So it's 237 people.
Of all levels, of all kinds, different countries, different parts of the social hierarchy.
Yeah, and I was going to ask you, there's some really extraordinary stories that I had never run across, and I have a few here, but I was just wondering if you had a favorite of the, somebody who just has this incredible story that feels encapsulates something about
there's like. There's so many.
I know.
There's so many. I mean, really, it's a story of how people rise in the American system. First of all, I needed to write this book. This is book number 8 for me. And I had written about Latin America for all the books that preceded it. And it struck me that in my lifetime, when I came to this country as a 10-year-old from Lima, Peru, there were 2 million people, 2 million Latinos counted in this country. And now there are 64 million. We are the largest Spanish-speaking nation in the world, second only to Mexico. We are larger than any other Latin American country. The number of people here was what made me realize when I was speaking to my editor about what I was going to write for the next book. It's Latino nation, there is a Latino nation here. Latin America is here. And so that's really the reason for writing it. But of all the stories, my favorite stories are the ones where a grape picker in California who comes over the border at age 16 becomes the top neurosurgeon in the country. Somebody identifies him in the school system, pulls him up, sponsors him, and this young man ends up at Harvard Medical School, and he is now the most innovative neurosurgeon in the country. Stories like that, and there's one after another. There are so many there was a young boy who comes over at 4 years old in the Peter Pan. I don't know if you know the Peter Pan exodus out of Cuba in 1960 through 1964. And these kids were sent over by themselves. They were put on airplanes by themselves, age 4 to age 16, and they came over. Sometimes they didn't see their parents again for 4 years. Sometimes they didn't see their parents again for more than 30 years. And this boy comes over at age 4. He's met by someone who is, you know, a distant friend of the family. They raise him. His parents come over 5 or 6 years later. He becomes the CEO of AT&T. I mean, these stories are extraordinary, and they're various. I mean, there are all kinds of stories like that.
Yeah, I was struck by so many of them. There's the student activist, too, right, who just sort of rises in there, but is also navigating absolutely incredibly difficult life circumstances, manages to thrive. I mean, I think that's one of the big threads of the book, right, is this very clear, statistically proven sort of like idea of like what Latinos, how Latinos function in society. And it seems to be like a case of like real family building moving forward.
It's all about making it in America. But you know, I also have to add that one very important part of the story is not just the people who come in their lifetimes, but it's also what struck me, and the reason I wanted to write this book is because we don't really realize the history, because we have been here all along. I mean, this country, half of it, all the way up to Wyoming and all the way over to Kansas, was Mexico at one time. And when the pioneers went west in Westward Ho, sort of manifest destiny and just grabbing Mexican land. I mean, they were sent by the U.S. government. They said, take your stick and go out and put it in the ground and it's yours. Well, it wasn't theirs. It was Mexican land and pushing the Mexican people out. But that all that history is really not studied in classrooms in this country. And I wanted to focus on the history. And not only that, but the extraordinary Latinos in the past who were here all along. Latinos have fought in every American war since the American Revolution. There were heroes, men and women, who fought in, for the revolution. And it goes right through. They fought in the Civil War. They fought in the two world wars. They fought in the Korean War, Vietnam, you name it. And every time, a larger quantity of people fighting for this country. More than 20% of the military is Latino. 1 out of 4 United States Marines is a Latino. The history of the Latinos is very, very strong in this country. And people just don't know it. They don't study it in the classrooms. And one of my big missions is to educate people about this extraordinary community of people that we are as Latinos.
Right. And I actually had a bunch of like questions for you about like the idea of visibility and invisibility when it comes to these historical figures. This is a tiny one, which I didn't even write one, but my family spent a good deal of time in Texas near Galveston, right? And Galvez was Latino, but like, I wonder if you'd mind talking a little bit about the ways in which figures like Galvez kind of get slightly smudged out of the idea of being Latinos and then just become sort of co-opted, I guess would be, right. That may not be the right word, but
yeah.
Yeah, well, sort of absorbed and not really representing who they were. Bernardo Galvez was Spanish. He was the governor of Louisiana and Florida. And he was sent during the time of the American Revolution. He was down there and actually mustered all these troops of Latinos, of Hispanics, up from the Caribbean to come and fight in the Revolutionary War. The George Washington at that point was actually completely confounded by the British, because the British had blockaded the shore, the Atlantic shore, and there was no way to get ammunition up to the patriots who were fighting in the Revolutionary War. Bernardo Galvez said, I'm going to help you, and I'm going to bring troops, thousands of Hispanics, Latinos, whatever we would call them differently at that time. They were Spanish colonial subjects were coming up, thousands of them, and they were taking ammunition up the Mississippi River to George Washington's troops to fight the Revolutionary War. And George Washington actually said, I could never have won the American Revolutionary War if it had not been for that Hispanic, that Latino help, not only in munitions, but in actual personnel to fight the war. So one of the people who came up was actually a Spaniard who was the highest level Spaniard fighting for the Revolutionary War. His son was David Farragut. Mm-hmm. And his name was actually Jaime Ferragut, but it was changed to David Farragut. And you know, you walk into Washington, D.C., you see a statue of David Farragut. This was the man who, in the Civil War, absolutely was the high. First of all, he was the first admiral of the United States Navy. He fought heroically in the Civil War. He actually was the statue of him is there. There's not a word that says that he is Latino or of Hispanic origin. There's a bust of him in the U.S. Army Navy Club. There is no mention of him as being a Latino. But here was the man who said, very famously, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. Now, we all know that quote, and it's quoted in American history books, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead, but we don't know that that was Latino. And, you know, that sort of thing is not taught in the classrooms.
Right, and I wanted to say, like, I think Farragut is also has become, like, a big name for Irish bars.
Oh, yes.
You're right, so, like, right. There's this whole other, like,
right.
association that people have with the name, right? Like, right. That it's, yeah. So that issue of, like, visibility and invisibility is something that the book addresses,
yeah,
right,
yeah.
In really, really interesting ways. And I think that one of the sort of, like, challenges for, like, a lot of us who are Latino is sort of navigating the fact that we're both part of this large, I mean, we all love, I think you actually do a really good job of, like, there's a couple of things that seem to unite all of us, right? Like, there's family, there's really good food, right? So weirdly, like, I think everybody,
we
like,
can dance
bachata, you know, like, it doesn't matter where we are, we're gonna get cumbia and bachata and salsa, and we're, like, all down for that, right? So, like, there's commonalities that I think are, but there's also this extraordinary quote that you have, right? The idea that we are together, but together doesn't mean we are the same, and I think that's sort of, like, the weird sort of central tension there, right?
Yeah. There's huge diversity in the Latino population. I mean, we are of every race of man. And this is something that we have begun to understand more and more as science figures out our genetic structure and we go into 23andMe or whatever it is and we figure out. I am every race of man. I am indigenous, I am black, I am white, I am Asian, I'm all of those things, and it's not unusual. I mean, when you have a people that has been in this hemisphere for 500 years mixing it up, it was the most extraordinary experiment, I think, in human genealogy, is when the conquistadores came and started mixing up with the indigenous, because the men came without the women. So right away there was a population of what we call mestizos. We were already mixed, and then we mixed with the Atlantic slave trade, which people don't realize. There were 12 million Africans who were robbed from their homelands, chained and brought over in slave ships. 350,000 went to the United States. Only 350,000 of 12 million. 1 million died en route, and all the others, 10 million plus, were in Latin America. So we are very, very racially mixed with African blood. And then there was the huge wave of Asians who came in. I mean, in the country where I was born, in Peru, we were hugely infused by Chinese and Japanese and Korean, so we have that blood as well. So that diversity makes us the most diverse Americans in real terms, in actual mix. And it shows. I mean, it shows because, depending on where you are from in Latin America, you have a different sort of mix.
Yeah, and I think that's both like one of the great virtues and beauty of being part of the community. And I also think it may be one of the ways in which political representation, for example, has been a problem. You go through some extraordinary statistics, right? We're, what, almost 20% of the population. And I think when we get to publishing, we're like 7% of...
Yeah.
I was just wondering if you'd mind telling that story of like building political coalitions as Latinos. Like I found the Willy Velasquez story particularly inspiring, but also like, oh my gosh, it's a really rough hill to climb, right?
Right. Well, we are now slightly more than 20% of the American population. We will be 30% by the year 2050, which is an extraordinary thing, right? One out of three people will have some Latino blood and or heritage. And so what does this mean in terms of politics or simply of a representation? You know, we are only 4% of Hollywood movies, even though we are the largest group of movie-going people. I mean, we are box office makers. The Latino population is very, very popular in the movies. We're only 4% of the people who are actually represented in the movies. In boardrooms across the United States, we're only 1% of the boardrooms, corporate boardrooms in this country, although we represent 1 in 5 people in the country. So there's a really definite disjuncture between our representation in the places of power and our representation in the population as a whole. So, you know, there's a lot of work to be done. There's a lot of work to be done. Willy Velasquez, whom you mentioned, was living in the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s, and he was a professor in the Southwest. He was also teaching at Harvard. Harvard brought him in to teach about politics, Latino politics. His students were Barack Obama and a number of other people who were actually realizing that the Latino population was the great untapped population as far as political representation is concerned. We have, although we have a great representation and great power in the community, as large as we are, and as economically viable as we are, we don't, as a population, we don't vote in the numbers that we should, which has created a big hole for, I should say, a big opportunity for the Republican Party, because even though Latinos tend to the Democratic Party, the fact that we don't vote as much as we should. I mean, there are places in Texas that are 90% Latinos and only 17% of them go to the polls. So it's a huge opportunity for the Republicans to actually recruit. And they have done remarkably well in the last few years.
With Latinos, yeah.
With Latinos.
And that's also proving true in the polls right now.
Right.
And I was actually kind of struck, again, one of the things that I love about the book is how you go deep with this history. And there's like some extraordinary and kind of very perceptive stuff coming from like Richard Nixon, right, of all people.
Yeah. Well, I like to say we're a population that really has no name because we've been given so many names. You know, we were labeled Latinos. Actually, the whole hemisphere was labeled Latinos by Napoleon. Napoleon, who had invaded Spain in the early 1800s, and he actually occupied Spain and then realized, wait, you know, there's all this colonial empire that Spain has, and we're going to try to own that as well. So the Napoleonic forces actually tried to occupy the Latin American countries. They never made a go of it, but in the process, they were trying to, like Napoleon himself was saying, I want you to understand, as you know, the Americas, that you are actually Latin. And Latin, you're French. You know, you're just like us. You're just like the French. We are Latin, and just you know, as French as we are. So the word Latino or America Latina became you know the operative term for us. And then you know, years later comes along Richard Nixon. And Richard Nixon says, well, you know, I grew up in California. I worked with the farm workers because his father was a grocer. And so Nixon said, you know, I worked with these people. I actually went to with my father's truck and picked up farm goods from them. And why aren't they voting for me? So the second round, when he was up for re-election, he made a real effort to court Latinos, and he established Hispanic Heritage Day. That was Richard Nixon. And he established a lot of Hispanic heritage institutions, and he brought Latinos and Hispanics into the White House and made the treasurer, the first Latina treasurer of the United States was under Nixon. So Nixon was really pushing for Latinos. And in fact, when he went for re-election, he reaped the rewards because they came out in numbers to vote for him. So that's where we got that name, Hispanics. And then, of course, years later comes along the academy, the universities, and people who are eager for us to actually represent equity in gender. So we're given Latinx suddenly. A very small percentage of the Latino population actually uses the term Latinx. But, you know, our name changes as we go along, which is part of the story.
I mean, and I think it's like a part of the story with small that reflects the largeness, right? Which is that I think that there's always a temptation anytime you have a group, you want the group to be tidy and for the story to be one story and for everything to be simple. And one thing that Latino Land makes very clear, it's like, no, this is, yeah, we're all here. We all have incredible commonalities, but it is a rich, weird, and multifaceted story.
Absolutely. Yeah. And when it comes down to it, we mostly describe ourselves as Mexican Americans or Peruvian Americans or Colombian Americans. But, you know, pressed to actually, I mean, I was walking down the street just here in Chicago on State Street, and there was a Latino walking his dog, and he had a big boombox in the back, and he was playing bachata music. And I thought, well, you know, one of my people. I think you feel this in a way. You feel the unity in circumstances like that. And, you know, we all work together once we're in this country. We're all sort of stop at construction sites, and I always make a point to ask, where are you from, where are you from, and what's your story? This is how I wrote this book. And there are, you know, Ecuadorians working alongside Hondureños. They're working alongside Guatemaltecos. There are, you know, all sorts of combinations of Latinos who would identify themselves as Salvadoran or Cuban and not necessarily even Hispanic or Latinos.
Right. I was kind of struck by this. I was in Mexico City recently, and I had never been to Mexico City, and I fell in love so hard for that city. But there's a... So as a Colombian growing up, one of my favorite things like is heavy metal, right? So like there was like a huge love of Iron Maiden in Bogota. That's just a thing that happens. And then I went there, and there were like all these posters for Anthrax, like the metal band, like everywhere. It just made me so happy. I just realized that like it's weird sometimes, like the ways in which those cultural sort of like alliances form. It's like, oh yeah, like that is the thing that matters. Also, I mean, Mexico City is totally a metal city, right? Come on, an eagle eating a snake, that's... Can't get more metal than that, right?
You can't, absolutely not. No, but that speaks to the diversity.
That speaks to the diversity, yeah, I was going to say. Like,
absolutely.
I had a question about, like, that speaks a little bit about, like, the one pattern that you sort of identify very, very clearly that I always sort of thought about just with the braceros, right? Which is this idea, oh, we need workers, let's get these workers. And then they're here, and then all of a sudden, people decide that we don't need them, even though we do, and then they want to get them out, right? I always thought of that as a single moment in history, and I think your book makes it very clear that this is a repeated pattern of, like,
totally
need and repulsion, right?
Yeah. Even now, and even with my father. My father came to this country as a student, and I'll explain why, because this was during World War II, and all the students in the universities were emptied out, and gone to war, particularly the male students. So they were all the classrooms were cleared out of young men. And the United States went down to Latin America and said, no, we need to, you know, the universities are going to collapse if we don't have people in them. So they went down and they offered places to good students, and my father was a good student, to come up to go to college in the United States. So this was very much like the Bracero movement, because they needed students. They didn't want the universities to collapse, so they started bringing the students up. My father was one. He went into the war effort. He actually worked for General Electric building turbines for the American war effort. And then when the war was over and the young men came back, then that was it. You know, we don't need you anymore. Out. It was the same thing with the braceros who came in to pick in the Californian fields, and they came on a seasonal basis, and then they were pushed out. There was a moment, there were many moments actually, when millions of Mexican Americans were forced out, when those waves of young men kept coming back from the wars, and then the laborers were pushed out. So this has happened repeatedly. I mean, this is not just, it has either gone by force, and when it has happened by force, under President Clinton, there was a huge purge of 2 million people who were sent back to Mexico, along with a lot of American citizens who were just rounded up because they had Hispanic names and because they identified as Mexican American, put on buses and sent back to Mexico, even when they were Americans. It's really quite a sort of horrifying story, frankly.
Yeah. And that kind of brings me to, like, so I write fiction and mostly in fiction, and so, and even then I think I feel I have like I'm obsessed with politics. I think a lot of people are at this point like nervously reading things. But yeah.
Juan's novel is, well, I should mention, is called Extended Stay, and it is a horror novel with shades of politics embedded.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for the plug. Everybody should buy 500 copies of it, and yes. But what I was going to say about this is, I had not realized until I read your book that I kept reading, oh, immigration reform. You were like the first person to realize that, like, there hasn't really been like an actual immigration reform bill since 1986.
A ridiculous situation, because the situation at the border right now, and there are so many of us Latinos who, you know, find that whole border scene as troubling as anybody else. There has not been an immigration act since the 1980s. It's been serially knocked off the desks of anybody in Congress. And the most recent one was just last year, attempt to actually fix the immigration problem. And it just keeps, nothing gets done. And presidents are afraid of it. And so we are stuck with a situation that we have endured now for almost 60 years.
I mean, and that brings me to like one of the parts that I found very, very moving, because I know there was a personal connection to it. But that is both in the real, like, incredibly, like, sort of nightmare situation of being a dreamer, right? Which is, you're here, you belong here, you've lived your whole life here, but you could get kicked out at any moment, right? That's... Would you mind talking a little bit about Don Graham and his work for the Dreamers? Because that really, I teared up a little bit. I was not expecting to find like the Washington Post figure be that.
Yeah, it's amazing. So yeah, Donald Graham was the owner and publisher of the Washington Post. And it was a family-owned newspaper until it was sold to Jeff Bezos. But Don Graham, who was very, very devoted public servant, really running the Washington Post, he when he left and he sold the newspaper and he left the newspaper, he looked around for something to do, and he focused on the DACA, the Dreamers, because he was looking to help a population that was the most abject, in his view. And he found that these dreamers, who were who knew only the United States of America. Most of them had come over at the age of three or four over the border with their parents. They hadn't been born here because the birthright, of course, is automatic citizenship. They hadn't been born here, but they'd been here since they were 2, 3, 4 years old. And they had no rights whatsoever. They could be kicked out at any time. They couldn't get a driver's license. They couldn't get a university education in some states. And Graham, Don, decided that this was the population that needed most help in the country. And so he started an organization called Dream.us. And he actually pays tuition for thousands of DACA kids coming up, when you look at what has happened to these kids, they've gone on to become surgeons, they've gone on to become engineers, they've gone on to become urban planners. They're generally as supported as they are by this organization. They're hitting top grades in their universities. They're the population that most sticks with the university education. It's really rather a remarkable story because now, of course, the Dreamers are threatened. I mean, the first thing that former President Trump said he would do was to get rid of all the Dreamers, deport them. So they live with this fear all the time. And, you know, even so, they've been succeeding because of programs like this that help them through university careers. It's really a very moving story.
It is. And it's, there is a part of me that just reminds, like, that the book kind of reminds me, because I tend to get cranky about my own frustrations with, like, my own family and, like, you know, everything else, and my own country of origin. It's like, it is incredible how much progress and achievement happens in spite of these obstacles, right? I had, like, a question that has a little bit to do with that idea of progress and both visibility but invisibility in entertainment, if we can go back to that one. Because, I mean, I knew about Raquel Welch, right? That she's
Latina.
She's Latina, right? I did not know about Linda Carter, right?
Yeah, Wonder Woman.
Wonder Woman.
Was Latina.
Yeah. So there's these sort of like stories of, but your book does a really great job of talking about like both the history of music as it shows up in Latina and also like key weird early figures. I mean, Ricky Ricardo's obviously sort of everybody's sort of the I Love Lucy. But would you mind just giving us a taste of what we
see
there?
Yeah, rock and roll is full of Latinos, of course. I mean, from the very beginning, from Richie Valens.
Oh,
Richie, yes. Richie Valens, who's an amazing story. He was he could hardly speak Spanish. He was Latino, definitely. His father was a singer. He could hardly speak Spanish, but when he cut the first song in Spanish that he did, it became a huge hit. I mean, it was the top of the charts all along. He was killed very early in his life. He was I think he was barely 19 when he was went down in an airplane. But I mean, it starts with that, and it goes on to one after another, Joan Baez, Carlos Santana, to the point where now, you know, the artists in Metallica are Latinos, and a good percentage of music is Latino in this country. But the stories are really remarkable of how much the art world is possessed really by Latinos. But Latinos are the economy as a whole would drop through the floor if Latinos were suddenly removed from the economy. Right now, the Latinos, if you were to take them as a nation, have such buying power and have such a place in the economy that we would be the fifth largest GDP in the world. Not in the country, in the world. Latinos represent the fifth largest gross domestic product in the world. People don't realize that. You know, we wouldn't have bread. I mean, we wouldn't have Wonder Bread, Pepperidge Farm, Arnold, you name it, Entenmann's, all of that is Latino owned. And you know, that, it's there. But when speaking of invisibility, nobody knows, you know, that that's the case. It's a 44%, you know, almost 50% of all the growth in the economy in this country has been supported by Latinos and Latino small businesses. It's really quite remarkable.
I also remember, and this may not have been in the book, but I think it connects a little bit, that there is this real global preoccupation with declining birth rates, right? Like with the idea that, in general, developed countries are aging and do not have enough of an influx of younger populations. And it's kind of amazing how, in many ways, Africa as a whole is very young, but also like the Hispanic population as a whole is younger than the average, right? I mean, there's more
younger, and we reproduce quite in high rates. We tend to have larger families, so yeah, the growth rate is only going to go up. That's for sure.
Right, and it's, you know, for people who are on like the conservative spectrum, really, really worried about like the social security declining and stuff, like having a younger population that is sort of paying the taxes so that they can support the rest, that's us, right?
It's super important. Yes, that is definitely us. And you know, another thing, you know, we were talking about race and diversity just within the population of Latinos. We are also the population that is most likely, according to Pew Research, I wouldn't have been able to write this book without Pew Research, because their figures are such testament to the strength of this population. According to Pew, we also intermarry more than any other population, any other segment of the American population. So we cross racial boundaries, you know, when we marry and we have children. So that's a diversity. We represent the very essence of diversity, in other words.
Marie, could I ask you a slightly difficult question about that, the issue of race, right? I keep thinking about this in terms of my own experience with my own family, the ways in which Colombia, for example, is highly segregated, right? Your book does a really good job of talking about some of this, but like there is a real still, right, a problem with colorism and race.
Huge.
Colombia is always class, always, but...
And kind of a blindness, too, because, you know, I mean, you travel in Mexico and you see all the billboards are of whites. Yeah. You don't see the indigenous representatives. You don't see the very large Afro-Mexican population that exists. So there is a natural sort of colorism that goes on, which, you know, it also exists in the African-American population here. I mean, we can't really get rid of that in our countries of origin, for sure. I mean, there is a hierarchy that is left over from the colonial days, that it's really the white people are at the top. There's no question about that in any of the Latin American countries. We get over that a bit when we come to this country, but it remains to some extent.
Right. And poor Marie got to hear two writers who adore your Bolivar biography, and we told you how much we loved it. I think we talked at her for like 30 minutes how much amazing this biography is. But like, it's at the race and the problematics of race are sort of at the root of empire, right? Of the colonies.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yes. Yeah.
So we're down to 5 minutes. I have like a question that is, you can totally definitely answer in like super easy 5 minutes, not a problem, which is, so you've written this, how many pages? It's 700 pages, this gigantic, amazing book with this big sweep. How do you see that book speaking to the moment that we're in, like right now, as a nation?
Well, first of all, I hope it speaks most strongly to the fact that we are underrepresented in this country in vast ways, not only historically, but in education, in the corridors of power in this country. I think my book is meant to address that. My book is meant to teach people that this is a population of great promise. So it's also a book about the future, because if you're talking about the future of America, you've got to pay attention to the Latino population because that is the future. I mean, we are very much a part of the future of this country. We've been a part of the past, and I've tried to prove that as well, all the way from the beginning, constitutional moment, you know, that foundational moment of this country. We were there. We were there. We helped win that Revolutionary War. So if my book does anything, it will correct the invisibility, and it will speak to the future of this country, which depends so much, and people really need to realize that, on us Latinos, and the work that we can do, and the work that we have done, and the work that we will do in the future.
I want to say that I just adored this book. I thought it was just an amazing, amazing book. Thank you so much for writing this beautiful book, and thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, and thank you for coming.
Thank you also for coming.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.